There's a great quote about songwriting from Vince Gill. It goes, when you ask a songwriter his favorite song, he always says, the next one. And that holds true, I think, for this month's guest on Write You a Song. Hey, I'm Tom Maley, and thank you for listening to this podcast. It's a production of Bonneville Communications, and a big thanks to Songwriter City for helping set up this month's interview. Songwriter City, by the way, can bring many of these songwriters that we've had on this very show to your corporate event. Think about it, them all sitting around in a guitar pool style situation performing their biggest hits for your guests. Sounds outstanding. It's easier to do than you think, too. Go to songwritercity.com. Now, like several of our guests, Neil Thrasher is another longtime Nashville songwriter. He got his start in the mid-90s as part of a duo with Kelly Shiver called Thrasher Shiver. And while the act held promise, they had a song reach the top 40. They sang a little backup for a pretty big star from the 90s that you'll hear about in just a minute. It never really took off because, as Neil says, he became more and more focused on songwriting. Well, fast forward to now, 2020, and Neil has been writing hit songs for a quarter of a century for the likes of Rascal Flatts, Reba, and Jason Aldean. But he's not about to take it easy. In fact, kind of paraphrasing that Vince Gill quote, Neil thinks some of his best writing has still yet to be heard. Neil Thrasher, thank you for joining us today on Write You a Song.
Man, thanks for having me. My pleasure.
I was just reading to somebody the list of songs that you've written that have become huge hits, and the list is so long, I actually had to take a breath. Which...
What? I'm trying to make it longer.
You've done so, so well, and I want to get into all of these songs that you've written. Some of them are just so iconic for contemporary country music, but I remember you. I've been at the radio station where we're recording this, KNCI in Sacramento. My partner and I have been here doing mornings for 27 years, and we remember when a little duo called Thrasher Shiver came through back in the mid-1990s, and we were pretty impressed by you guys then. And it didn't really quite take off the way you wanted it to, but you actually had a career first as one half of a duo.
I did, and the reason I moved to town, I mean, I think probably 95% of the guys that moved to town the writers that wound up writing songs moved to town to be an artist, and yep. I did the same thing, and everything just kind of evolved into writing. You know, in pursuit of my artist career. And like you said, in 94, 95, me and Kelly Shiver put the duo together under the tutelage of Bob Doyle, who, of course, manages Garth Brooks and all that. And he put us together. And we went after it. And we were writing a lot of songs at the time, too. And we wrote about half the songs on our first record. We're doing radio tour and things like that and doing the things that new artists do. And in the meantime, back in Nashville, my songs started getting recorded by other artists, by bigger artists. And it was kind of a neat thing to be going on while I was out on the road. Eventually it just kind of started snowballing. And that was kind of when I decided, after about 4 years of doing the artist thing, I finally just decided what would happen, you know, if I devoted all my time to songwriting. And that's what I did, the decision I made. I came off the road and just devoted all my time to writing songs. And the rest was history, I guess.
Did you ever second guess that decision?
Negative. Never. No, I don't. I still get to perform, you know, I still get to, yeah, do live shows and whatnot. I still get to sing and all that, but I'm just I never second guess it. I believe that that's where God led me to do, and I just followed my heart on that. I really did. I would be lying if I said I missed the stage like that, and don't think about every now and then. Don't think about what might have been as an artist, but I'm so thankful that it turned out the way it did, and I don't regret any of it.
Well, because the other songwriters that I've talked with, I mean, all of them can sing, but you, watching your videos, you have an amazing voice. And then I went back and listened to some of the Thrasher Shiver stuff. And, I mean, the harmonies on your song, Be Honest, which I think charted. I think that was a top 40.
Yeah.
Your vocals are, like, really, really good.
Be honest. Is this where you want to be? Be honest. Are you still in love with me? Look deep in your heart, then tell me what you see. Be honest with me.
Shane McAnally also has a great voice, and his first album was like, holy cow, this guy can sing.
Yeah, he's a really good singer. Jeffrey Steele's a great singer. The list goes on and on and on.
So, but for, and I guess that's just, I think some people wonder, why would you want to be behind the scenes when you could be out front?
It's just a different, it's a different road to hoe. Mm-hmm. The path it takes to get there. Both paths are difficult, and you have to pick one or the other sometimes. And I think at that stage in my life, when the artist thing started, we had our first daughter. She was 1 year old, and I'm on the road doing radio tour, and it really felt more like an out to mm-hmm. me to have some success at songwriting and making the decision to come off the road and do that. It was an out for me, I just, at that stage in my life, I just didn't desire it anymore. I didn't desire the artist life anymore.
And you come from a musical family, so your dad was part of the Thrasher Brothers gospel act?
Yep, my father sang gospel music his whole life since he was a little boy, all the way up until I was in college. I mean, he that's what they did, and I was on the road with him when I was a little fella. I've been on buses and in bunks since I was a little, old enough to talk. So I know what that was like mm-hmm. for a long time. And it wasn't really anything that I had missed, but I think Dad was like, I don't know how he felt about me doing the artist thing. I think he always wanted me to, I just saw how hard it was on him. And that was another factor. I saw how hard it was on him, just the road life period, being gone all the time and everything. And once again, it just the songwriting thing. And I wouldn't be writing songs today if it wasn't for my wife. I probably would still be doing the artist thing to this day if I hadn't met my wife. She's the one that encouraged me to write songs.
Is she also the one that inspired you to write songs?
Absolutely. She was working for Major Bob Music. She actually was running Major Bob Music when I met her, and that's Bob Doyle again. So Garth Brooks was a writer there, and she was running that whole organization as far as the publishing side goes. And when I met her, and how I met her is a cool story, because I probably would have never met her if it weren't for Garth Brooks. I was singing with a group. This is before Thrasher Shiver. I was singing with another group, and we were in Beaumont, Texas, doing a benefit for Bob Hope High School, and Garth Brooks was on the show, and he was, I think The Dance had just come out, and he was working on his second record on the No Fences record. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we were on the same bill as he was. He was closing the night, but earlier that afternoon, we were doing sound check, and Bob Doyle and Garth were in the out front, and they heard us do our sound check, and Garth asked us to sing on the No Fences record. And of course we said, well, heck yeah. So we went and sang on the Cut Wolves on the No Fences record. And that's how I met my wife.
Did Garth cut any of your songs ever?
I've never had a Garth cut, and wrote it Major Bob forever. And I tried, but I never did get one.
So you got into songwriting late 90s, early 2000s. How long before you had your first real taste of success? I know that Diamond Rio cut one of your songs in like 96 or 97.
Yep.
That's What I Get for Loving You.
Yeah, it was my first hit.
That's what I get for loving you. Heaven's right here in my hands. A dream that
I was writing with Kent Blasey. Like, that was one of, you know, the first people that my wife set me up with. And he and I wrote that song while I was on the road doing radio tour with Thrasher Shiver. That song went to number 2 in 96.
Mm.
And sometimes that would be all that some of the DJs wanted to talk about when we got there. We'd talk a little bit about Thrasher Shiver and our tour, and then they'd bring up the Diamond Rio hit. And that's really how I got my first taste of success in the writing part of this. But it was funny. We were on the road. I think I was in Steubenville, Ohio one time. And I got a phone call from my wife, and she was crying. And I said, "What is wrong?" And she goes, "We just got our first check in the mail for That's What I Get for Loving You." it was like we were rich and we really weren't, because it helped out a lot. It got us out of debt, you know.
The sound of her voice, were you like, "Oh crap, is it that big or is it that small?"
No. Yeah, it was great. I'll never forget that.
That is so cool. So then what was the next hit that you got on the radio?
Well, let's see. We had a few years pass. And then in 1999, me and a buddy of mine, Michael Delaney, who I've written a lot of stuff with,
mm-hmm.
we had What Do You Say for Reba.
And that song has a very interesting backstory. Where did the inspiration for that come from?
It actually came from sitting at the intersection, like the first verse says, and looking over. I can tell you where the intersection is too in Nashville, when I was sitting there and looking over at those adult bookstores and all the X's in the windows that are lit up and all that stuff. That's where the beginning of that came from.
Mm-hmm. Did you know when you were sitting there that this could be a song idea?
No, it was the start of a song.
Oh, really?
You know, it was a snippet, and you take it into a writing appointment and see where it goes. That's how they really happen. You know, we keep ideas and titles typed down and written down constantly, but that's how that song gets started.
Stuck at a red light outside an adult bookstore. Your son said, "Daddy, what are all those X's for?" As the light turned green, he changed the subject fast. Started talking about football as they drove right past. "So what do you say in a moment like this, when you can't find the words, oh, to tell it like it is? Just bite your tongue.
And you and Michael have written a lot together, and a lot of the songwriters that I've talked with, they have people that they co-write fairly frequently with, but they also bounce around, you know, and write with different people. But it seems like, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you kind of have a small selection of people you write with. Is that?
Well, I've branched out and written with quite a few people, but the majority of my success is a small handful of guys.
Michael Delaney being one of them.
Michael Delaney, Wendell Mobley.
Right.
And Tony Martin.
Is it just because you guys click? Like friends just, you know, that sometimes you just go together, you get each other's jokes, read each other's minds?
It is. And you find those guys that you click with early on. And writers hope and pray that they find those guys early on that they can work with and that are easy to work with. That complement what you bring to the table. And
that was going to be my next question. In what facets do you complement, say, Michael and vice versa?
It works both ways, man. It's like it's melodic and lyric both ways. For instance, on Flyover States, Michael brought in that idea, and he actually had some of those chord changes when he brought it in. And he had run that, he'd run Flyover States by four or five different other writers, and he said that they didn't jump on it. And when he brought it into me, I'm like, good Lord, man, we can freaking paint a landscape with this song. Let's try that. So off we went.
A couple guys in first class on a flight from New York to Los Angeles. Kind of making small talk, killing time, flirting with the flight attendants. 30,000 feet above could be Oklahoma. Just a bunch of square cornfields and wheat farms, man, it all looks the same. Miles and miles of back roads and highways connecting little towns with funny names. Who'd want to live down there in the middle of nowhere? They've never drove through Indiana. Met the man who plowed that earth, planted that seed, busted his ass for you and me. You're caught a harvest moon in Kansas, and they'd understand why God made those flyover states.
And you guys said that when you heard the final recording of Flyover States that Jason Aldean did, he nailed it. And you kind of talked a little bit about the apprehension that you sometimes have as a songwriter when you listen to a song that you wrote maybe 4, 5, 6 months ago, and you had one idea in your head, and then the producer and the singer get together, or the band or whatever, and it comes out, and there's always a little bit of trepidation as to how they interpret it. Talk a little bit more about that.
I used to worry about that earlier on in my career. I don't so much anymore. I guess it's probably because we've been real fortunate with the cuts that we've gotten and the singles that we've had, because I've never been let down with the reproduction of one of my songs. I've never been let down with it.
Mm-hmm.
And Aldean and the Flats and everybody that's ever done anything of mine has always taken it to the next level. I always have. And so it's never been a worry of mine. That kind of went away early on, and not that it really matters, but I try to, when I demo my songs, I try to put them in the most best representative form as I can.
Mm-hmm.
After we write them. And I try to do them like I'm doing a record when I do my demos, like I'm doing them for me. So I put a little bit more time and effort into them, and I think that may help a little bit. If I give them a better template to follow, then that's cool. I think it does the song justice and the record justice.
Well, and there are artists who have recorded multiple songs of yours. Aldean's one of them. Tattoos on This Town, Flyover States, Review Town. Am I leaving any out?
Night Train.
And then Rascal Flatts, you've written a ton. And is part of that kind of like what we were talking about earlier with a co-writer? Are there certain singers that just kind of get you and your songwriting style more than others?
I mean, there's a lot of artists out there that are fans of certain writers and certain writers' voices. And you'll hear that from a lot of them. I've always related well. Of course, I'm really good friends with Gary LeVox, the lead singer for the Flatts. And he and I have always, you know, he's always related to my phrasing and the way I do things and the way I write and all that stuff. And we've written some cool stuff together. And for whatever reason, you know, Jason's like, our ranges are completely night and day.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a high singer, you know, and I cut everything in my key on the demos, but he relates to them, and he knows how to drop that key to fit him, and he likes where the notes go, and he loves where the phrasing. So he's always been, I guess you could say, a fan of the way I present my songs, and I've been very fortunate with him.
A place that's small, it's hard to do too much of her. And so much road to somewhere new. It ain't nothing but a review town. Broken hearts and rusted plows. Roots rip right up out of the ground. Never thought I'd ever leave it. Though it ain't nothing what it used to be. Population minus me. On the other side of that dust cloud.
Seems like Aldean, maybe your lyrics appeal to him because the songs that he's recorded of yours are kind of all small town, rural, kind of in defense of or in celebration of. But with Rascal Flatts, it's more about there's a lot of nostalgia and a lot of sort of romance. And
no doubt about that.
Where did Fast Cars and Freedom come from? That is such a cool phrase. I love where did that phrase come from? And then how did the song come about?
That's one of the few songs, probably one of like three songs in my whole catalog throughout my whole career. That's one of three songs that was completely finished without a title. And we wrote that song. Actually, the song was started by Wendell Mobley with a guitar riff. That guitar riff at the beginning of the song, he played that for me over the phone one time, and I was like, man, that sounds like something Keith Urban would play. So anyway, we had a writing appointment with Gary, and he broke that out. We started writing the song and never had a title. Done. So we just told Gary, he's like, man, just title it whatever you want to title it. So Gary wound up titling it.
Oh, really?
Well, we just told Gary, it's like, man, since we wrote it with you, you know, and y'all are thinking about cutting it, man, y'all just title it whatever you want. we don't have a title. We finished the whole song without a title, and we've done that like three times.
When you do something like that, it's a little out of the ordinary. Is there any part of you that kind of worries how it might be perceived, or are you like, yeah, this is different, nobody's done this, this is going to stand out?
No, I don't ever think about stuff like that anymore. We don't, I used to think about rules and we can't do this and can't do that. And I mean, there's certain things you can't say, but you know, I love like the freedom in the process like that. I love the freestyle writing like that and just seeing where it goes and seeing what happens. Sometimes a title just shows up, you know, and presents itself in the middle of the song somewhere while you're writing a story.
Mm-hmm. How often do you, like, you're in the middle of a write and then bam, like the real gist of the song hits you and then you either double back and start over or you figure out how to kind of manipulate it and work it around, you know, that thing that you just kind of came up with?
Yeah. No, you're always editing. You're constantly editing, going back, and it's all about cracking the code of the song. You know when you've cracked the code on the song and when that's the direction it needs to go. And early on in my career, I would turn in songs thinking they're done, and really and truly in the back of my head, knowing they're not done. I just wanted to turn the song in, wanted to be done with it, you know. And I wouldn't put a lot of effort into making it the best it could be.
Hmm.
And I learned that early on, but we're always editing and stopping. And I'm not one of these writers that tries to get in two or three songs a day just to get a song in and say whatever. And I actually just, I'm really anal about making it the best it can be.
How do you know when to walk away from something that isn't working?
That's another hard part. You got to show up and you got to stick it out. That's all you can do. I mean, I've had days when I show up and I'm like, this is not going good. And this is, I'm talking about like with new people. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, this is not going good. You'll be there sitting there for 3 hours and there's nothing, but you stick it out. And all of a sudden something happens or somebody says something that triggers something and off you go. So you have to trudge through all of the mud and all of the dullness and that comes with writing appointments. Sometimes you have to stick it out, and sometimes they don't go anywhere, and it's been a full day of nothing. And that's happened a lot.
Okay.
And that's it, but it's just part of it. You can't think that you can't write anymore, and you can't think that it's over and that this job sucks and all that. It's just part of the job. It really is.
Is that?
I've had those days with guys I've had a lot of success with.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that did you know that early on, or would you beat yourself up if you couldn't come up with something on a given day when you were younger?
I used to beat myself up when I was younger. Absolutely. I think every writer does. Every writer goes through, they beat themselves up. I think every serious writer does. Anybody that wants to write something good. And I also went through what every young writer goes through. You've written a great song a week ago or the previous day, and you go in the next day trying to beat that song. And if you have that kind of attitude, you'll drive yourself insane. If you're trying to beat the last song you wrote, you'll drive yourself crazy.
Because
it ain't going to happen.
Can you also drive yourself crazy by, let's say you write it's a great song and somebody cuts it, but for whatever reason, it doesn't get released. Maybe it gets buried on an album somewhere and it never really sees the daylight that you thought that it should. Does that ever happen?
How much time you got? I can go back to all the Rascal Flatts records and all the Jason Aldean records, and I can go down, and as thankful as I am for all the songs that they've released, there is 10 times as many hits that I've had. There's 10 times that many songs that I wish people could have heard.
Give me one example for each artist, and then we'll play a clip.
Let's just say Jason's last record. A song on there called "Better at Being Who I Am."
Mm-hmm.
To me, the song that to me is a song that deserves to be heard.
Well, you never liked it much, but I broke out these old boots again. Gonna jump in that old truck, head down to the bar, and hang out with an old friend. Been a while since I fired up a cigarette and got drunk on some draft beer. Where I'm going tonight, there's a good chance you won't want me back here. I tried to be what you were looking for, but I can't do that anymore. I'm better at being who I am, better at letting my rebel run. Ain't nothing about me worth a damn if I can't be.
Carrie Underwood song that me and Wendell and Steve McEwen wrote called "I Know You Won't" that never was released. It's been covered by Carrie did it. The Flats have cut it. Kelly Clarkson she's done it in her show live, but it's never been put out for the world to hear.
Your voice says
And for people who don't know, it's not necessarily up to, certainly not up to the writer, but it's also not necessarily up to the artist either what songs get released.
Yeah, not every time, no.
But at the same time, do you, and I know we're in a different era now where quote-unquote albums don't matter. I feel like they still do, and I think there's still a, I hope there's a place for albums forever and ever. But when you have really strong songs like you're talking about that don't get released, you just make that whole album better, though. Is that, I mean, is that a way to kind of placate yourself, to think that way?
Yes. Especially early on it did. I mean, album cuts early on when Jason and the Flats and Carrie Underwood and all them were selling 4 and 5 million albums every time they put one out, you know, it was nice to have multiple cuts on there. Those were the glory days.
Right.
I'm starting to notice a lot of artists now, they're just kind of cutting for singles, and they're not really doing full albums. I mean, Jason Aldean still does full albums. I don't think the Flats are doing an album. We can get that's a whole nother subject, though. I don't know. I probably got off of it for you there, but
no. But that has been touched on before, and it is definitely a concern for songwriters going forward.
Absolutely, it's a huge concern. Huge. We lost. We songwriters have lost a lot of income with the decline of album sales. Big time. I mean, it's a huge chunk. It doesn't translate over to the streaming industry. For songwriters, anyway.
Has anybody figured out, I don't know, a possible solution that you think might work? Or is it as bleak? Because, I mean, it sounds pretty bleak.
NSAI has worked their butts off for songwriters in that regard. And it's all pending still, the outcome of that and the percentage of streaming that we'll be able to partake in the future. It's still pending. And it's I don't know what the outcome's going to be. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. We're all just shooting for singles now. You have to get them cut first, but we're still trying to get cuts. But we all just pray for singles now.
So does that affect your songwriting? Does that affect your mindset when you go in?
It did early on. Like a few years ago when it was a new problem. But not anymore. I'm rejuvenated and I'm writing more than I have ever in my career right now. I went from this bitter spot to wanting to quit, wanting to like, you know what, we've had a good career and I was ready to slow it down and hang it up. And I was like, one day I was like, what? I'm not going to do that. I can still sing. I can still think. I still got a brain. I'm going to actually go after this harder. And I've signed a new deal with Spirit Music here in Nashville, and I'm ready to rock, man. We're rocking and rolling right now.
If you don't mind, let me throw some titles out there, some of your songs, and I want to kind of get the backstory a little bit, starting with Rascal Flatts, Take Me There, which was co-written by some dude named Kenny. Who? Why did he write that for Rascal Flatts or allow them to do it when that song is great? He could have done it.
Well, that song started. I was in bed one night and I heard my phone buzzing on the nightstand, and it said block call. And I knew I better answer it because, you know, there's only when you have a blocked call as a songwriter, you better pick it up because it's probably an artist.
Okay.
And so I answered it, and he goes, "Hey man, I got an idea for a song. I got the first line and I think the title." And he told me the first line: "There's a place in your heart nobody's been, take me there." And I was like, "Oh wow, man." So I said, "Me and Wendell, we'll see you tomorrow," whatever, you know. And so anyway, we wound up getting together, the three of us, and we wrote that song. And by the time we got everything done and got it demoed, and what Kenny failed to say was he was just about done with his record. He already finished his record. And I got it all demoed up, and it's all nice and everything. And Kenny was done with his record, and I said, "Frick, I'm gonna pitch this to Dan Huff and the guys. I'm gonna pitch it to Gary. I'm gonna send it to Gary," and I did. And they wound up cutting it, man. It was the first single off that album.
There's a place in your heart nobody's been. Take me there. Things nobody knows. Not even your friends. Take me there.
want to know the girl behind that pretty stare. Take me there.
You did write a song for Kenny that is like just such a great song for, I think, any dad with a daughter who's had to, you know, see them off. And and it's called There Goes My Life. Tell me about that. How did that come? Because you have three daughters?
I have two daughters.
Two daughters. Okay.
Yep.
That
was actually that's actually an idea that Wendell Mobley had. And he brought it up one day when I was out over at his house and we were writing. And he brought it up one day and I wrote it down. I wrote There Goes My Life, just the title part, down in an old notebook. And it sat in that notebook. And I remember it sat in that notebook for over a year. But throughout that whole year, I remember when I would flip through that notebook, I would see that thing, that title sitting there. There Goes My Life. I just sit there. And then one day he and I jumped on it. And he had some lines that he had jotted down too. And anyway, that song just kind of wrote itself once we jumped on it. And it evolved from Wendell, from something he had written down for a long time as well. But we knew when we wrote it that it was like, man, we had done something here.
A couple years of up all night and a few thousand diapers later, that mistake he thought he made covers up the refrigerator. Oh yeah, he loves that little girl. Mama's waiting to tuck her in as she fumbles up those stairs. She smiles back at him, dragging that teddy bear sleeve tight. Blue eyes and bouncing curls. He smiles. There goes my life. There goes. Clothes, 15 pairs of shoes on his American Express. He checked the oil, slammed the hood, said you're good to go. She hugged them both and headed off to the West Coast. And he cried, there goes my life. There goes my future, my everything. I love you, baby, goodbye.
There's something with your songwriting. You seem to have your own style of songwriting, and that, you know, country music is for better or worse, there are a lot of trends that kind of come and go. There are some of the writers that I've spoken with, they kind of fall into the trends, or they can go and they can write kind of trendy stuff, and then they kind of go back to traditional. But you just kind of do what you do. Is that conscious or unconscious? Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. It's both, actually. Early on, we wrote what we felt. I wrote what I felt as if I was writing it for me. And then I went through a phase of seeing country music kind of change, and we try to change with it. And I saw my success start to drop off because I was trying to adapt instead of sticking to what I was doing best.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of went full circle. I went through that little period and then finally said, nope, I got to go back to doing the way I do it. And as soon as I started going back to doing it the way I do it, I started getting more cuts again. It started picking back up. So that's also a good piece of advice for young writers. Stick to what you do and don't worry about following trends, because this business is cyclical, and it all comes back around again. So, but you know what I'm saying when I said
absolutely
it's kind of both.
It's kind of like just the way you handle yourself, the way you comport yourself. You just be yourself. Quit trying to, don't try and be like that group over there so you fit in with them, or that group over there. Just be you.
You can't, you can't try to be something you're not, for sure.
And then the ASCAP 2012 Song of the Year, Randy Houser's How Country Feels. I love that opening line, you were raised on an asphalt farm. Did that come about in the writing process, or was that something that you thought up ahead of time and thought,
that's something that, that happened in the room. That the song actually started with the guitar riff. That whole thing, that's just how the day started, was with that riff right there. And I don't even remember who said, you know, you were raised on an asphalt farm. I don't even remember who came up with that. It's just like lines started coming out to that riff, and that's how that song started.
That riff is almost AC/DC inspired.
Yeah, same feel.
You were raised on an asphalt farm. Ain't never heard a rooster crow. Never walked barefoot by a river. Felt the mud up between your toes. You never rolled in the hay. You never thrown in four-wheel. Climb up on in here, girl. Let me show you how country feels. Put your hair down, hair down. Get you some of this laid on back. Kick your shoes off, kick them off. Get you some of this slow down fast. I'll take you up and down these hollers and hills. Let me show you how country feels.
What is, are you working on something now? Do you have something now that maybe we'll look up a year from now and go, wow, that's a great song. Neil Thrasher wrote that.
I've got a few. We've got we just got a couple of Tim McGraw cuts, and I've never had a Tim McGraw cut until in the past year. One's called Sheryl Crow, and one's called Hold 'Em While You Got 'Em. And but as far as my new deal goes, I've written a couple of new songs that are brand spanking new that I'm really proud of that we just demoed. They haven't been cut yet, but they're on hold.
Well, we'll wrap this up, and I can't thank you enough for taking time today. I just want to kind of leave on this thought. You have been at this for 25, 30 years, and just hearing in your voice, like right there, I just finally got a couple of songs cut by Tim McGraw. This is still new and exciting to you. You admitted that you kind of went through a down period, but I love hearing that excitement in your voice. You're so far along in your career, and yet this is still driving you.
Yeah, it still feels new. It feels new again. It's kind of like a new. It is. I've gone through ups and downs, and right now it feels like, man, I feel like I'm starting again. It feels like a new beginning.
There's no finish line for you right now.
No, I'm not going to put a cap on it.
Well, country music needs you, so
keep. I appreciate that.
Keep going as long as you want.
I'm good. As long as I got my brain and I can still think and it's making sense.
And that will do it for this month's edition of Write You a Song. Thanks again to Neil Thrasher for joining us, and thank you to Songwriter City for helping set this up again. If you would like to bring out some of these songwriters and have them perform their hits acoustically for your audience, it's easy to do. Go to songwritercity.com. They can set it up anywhere in the country. Songwritercity.com. And don't miss next month's Write You a Song. It's going to be a bit different in that we're going to be talking with a songwriter who's much more a part of the Texas country music Americana scene than he is contemporary country, although he's trying to make a name for himself in Nashville, too. He's country influenced by a little bit of jazz, and a friend of mine described his storytelling style as poetry in a jean jacket.
I went down to Beaumont, where ballroom angels fly. Something in the air down there makes me afraid to die. So I looked across the channel. I couldn't take a view without you.
His name is Drew Kennedy, and he is with us next month on Write You a Song.
Passing through the midnight with a dome upon my ears, trying to beat the morning lost behind the wheel. Maybe after sunrise, wait another day, I'd be okay. I would be okay. Cause they've got stars in California walking down the streets, dancing on the boulevard in their golden satin sheets, busking on the corner for change, for tips, and for me. Battle.